The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 264, Marriage, Love, and the Songs of Solomon, Forgotten Key to the Doctrine and Covenants 132, and the Doctrine of Celestial Marriage by C. Jess Grosbeck. The chair is Tom Duncan. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Because the last minute change, we'll check and make sure you're in the right place. This is dramatic readings from, especially from Romans Volume 10. No? We're here at to hear Jess Grosbeck, and he's going to talk about some neat thing. Where is it? Have this all organized. Yes. Well, anyway, I can't find the official title of the thing. Anyway, you all know where you're at. If you recognize the name of Jess Grosbeck, you're in the right place. It's my privilege to introduce him. Well, Marriage, Love, and the Song of Solomon, and the Forgotten Keys to the Doctrine of Celestial Marriage. Jess Grosbeck is an MD, a physician, psychiatrist, and psychoanalyst. Received his degree, his MD degree from the University of Washington School of Medicine in June 1963. Published a whole slew of books and articles, the Smiths, Their Dreams and Visions in Sunstone in 1986, The Archetypal Image of the Wounded Healer, which I read in its published version, a very interesting, Journal of Analytical Psychology, 1986. Belongs to the American Academy of Psychoanalysis and is a union analyst in a group in North Pacific and a training analyst. Received tons of awards, the Outstanding Teacher of the Year, UC Davis, back in my old stomping grounds, Department of Psychiatry in 1986, Faculty Award for Outstanding Service, again in UC Davis, Department of Psychiatry, and that was in 1999. And with Diane Whitelock Grosbeck, they share 13 children and two families. So he ought to know a lot about celestial marriage and Song of Solomon, especially.
There's a lot of people here more about this topic than I do. I feel a little bit like the fellow who died in heaven, but he immediately was depressed because he realized he didn't have any talents, you know, and you have to have something outstanding in heaven. Of course, Peter said everybody has a talent in heaven, so he was quite depressed. And Peter talked with him for a while and said, well, you've got some talent, don't you? And he said, well, you know, I have nothing outstanding. He went through his history and said he was in the San Antonio flood in 45. And Peter said, well, hey, that's good. We've got no experts on the San Antonio flood in 45. Get your things together and we'll present. You'll feel right at home. So his spirits lifted a bit. He went through his preparation, got things going, and had a big meeting in heaven. He was going to present. His turn came up. And just before he went on, Peter said, by the way, Noah's in the audience. So anyway, this is going to be an interesting presentation. I don't know how this will be, but I'd like to say two things to all of you. Number one, you may want to experience this presentation in a different way than you ordinarily do. If you want to just listen to hear the ideas, that's certainly fine. But you may want to trip off in your own reverie. I recently learned a new way to really enjoy church meetings, all sorts of things, by being able to have my own inner dialogue. And I think that's a good, this might be a good topic to try that on. So anyway, I would, though, in all seriousness, like to thank so many of people who have been helpful to me with this, particularly Carl Sandburg, who really initiated this paper and my thinking about it. I'll say more about that in a minute. But to so many others, my good friend Tom Kearns, many other friends who have been so helpful and supportive, and particularly to my wife Diane, who I owe a great deep debt of gratitude for her great love and understanding concerning this topic and teaching. So let me begin then, and it begins with a conversation with Carl Sandburg. And he said to me about a year and a half ago, you know, Jess, DNC 132 in the Doctrine of Celestial Marriage does not mention love. And I stopped and I thought, that's right, it doesn't. And we talked more about that, but that really bothered me. I thought, well, now, what is this? How could this most sublime doctrine of celestial marriage that we Mormons believe in not mention love? After all, Joseph Smith said that the doctrine of celestial and plural marriage is the most holy and important doctrine ever revealed to men on the earth. And without obedience to that principle, no man or woman can ever obtain to the fullness of exaltation in the celestial glory. On another occasion, they wrote about the prophet's work concerning this very thing in the Deseret News in 1879. This manifestation of divine light, unfolding the purposes of God in the exaltation of his obedient children, making plain the celestial or eternal order of marriage, with endless increase and the extension of the glory of the sons and daughters of God, is the most momentous and magnificent unfoldment of the plans, purposes, and behests of the Almighty ever brought forth by the great seer of the 19th century. So that is an interesting kind of prelude to all of this. Yet, how could this most important of all doctrines and revelations be so without the mention of love? And where is love in this doctrine? Question one. I shall now begin to prime your thinking a little bit. Is then love part of celestial marriage? Must it be part of the celestial marriage experience? What love could this be? Certainly an answer must be oriented around the fact that love would have to be part of the most exalted and defined form of heavenly marriage. And would it not also involve some form of romantic love? Question two. If the above is true, that love would have to be part of celestial marriage and yet not mentioned, where is the missing key element in this about love that might help us? Question three. If love, and particularly romantic love, is assumed, it speaks naturally to the ultimate exclusivity of the relationship, of each being the one and only for each other, the two lovers becoming one in all ways. Yet how can this be reconciled with the apparent striking contradiction that part of the doctrine of celestial marriage contains the plurality of wives? This is a doctrine that husbands have more than one wife in the eternal scheme of things, both in time and eternity. How, for example, could a woman feel as though she were the one and only in this supposedly unique and divine union of the sacred marriage in the eternal marriage covenant aspect of celestial marriage, and yet also supposed to be an equal among many or one among many? Could the sacred marriage of the union or conjunctio be fulfilled in this fashion? And again, let me remind you that the two fundamental prongs of the doctrine of celestial marriage, as Joseph Smith at least revealed it, was that of the eternal marriage covenant between the two parties and plural marriage. Those were the two basic elements in it. How could this problem be resolved, particularly if a woman who felt the least of other women and felt inferior and outside other relationships, husband-wife relationship, how could she feel accepted in a one-to-one relationship? How could this prong take place? Well, today we're not going to resolve all the issues I've raised here. These are things to think about, and maybe as time goes on at another time we'll be able to resolve some of them. Today, I would like to focus on the first part of this issue, and that is the love aspect of the eternal marriage relationship. I'd like to focus on it by looking at what I consider the most sublime erotic love poetry, I think, that I know of in the English language, and certainly perhaps in all of our traditions, and that is the Songs of Solomon. And again, just as a note in passing, I hope today that no one feels that we're dealing in pornography. Pornography is different from true romantic erotic love. And let me just tell you the difference as I see it. Pornography is where one evokes certain erotic images, but they primarily have the focus of of an autoerotic activity for satisfaction. They are usually quite repetitive, banal, they're borrowed, and in the end are not fulfilling and flowering of the love relationship of the individual or individuals who may be involved. In contrast, true erotic love poetry and so forth is where it unfolds to the enhancement of the of two parties in their involvement. And I want to say more about that, in fact, because I think what we'll talk about today may hope to define that. The second point is that in the love relationship of romance, we need to clarify who is the leader in this process. And after many years of study, I can truthfully say it is the woman. Helen Fisher, the famous anthropologist, has now noted that even in primates, the woman is the initiator, the orchestrator, the leader of the whole process. Now, a lot of people say, well, don't men make the first attempts and the first steps to this? Well, that may be true, but if you follow it very closely, you'll find that the woman has earlier on given the cues and sets the stage for how it happens. So just to get that in mind, we know what how that happens, I believe. And I think, again, what we're going to talk about today will illustrate that. Now, let me sort of now develop the theme a little bit more. Extensive research, at least as far as I'm concerned, has revealed that probably the missing key to understanding the depth of romantic love is in the sacred teaching of the sacred marriage or the coniunctio, which is a symbolic, really archetypal picture of the marriage relationship that one can find in all the cultures of the world. And what we're going to see today from the Songs of Solomon is one edition of that. And I think, as we see, this will tie into DNC 132 and the doctrine of celestial marriage. And in just a moment, I'm going to give us a little background through our slides of what I mean by the sacred marriage and the archetypal pattern that has come to us from many sources. Now, remarkably, the Songs of Solomon, then, may contain the lost keys to this doctrine of celestial marriage. And in so doing, it transposes a contradiction into a paradox on a number of levels. And it does this in part by revealing a heretofore, as far as I'm concerned, unknown, subtle initiation rite of passage, particularly for the woman, but also for the man, in what apparently can be irreconcilable, contradictory aspects of this whole marriage relationship. And, of course, the goal of this initiation process is to reconcile irreconcilable opposites. Now, let me just say a word about that. We use those terms rather glibly, from contradictions to reconciling opposites. And I think Carl, a psychiatrist, had as much to say about this as anybody. Now, for example, if you experience a contradiction in life, in your life in some way, what happens is you get pulled in both ways. And eventually what we usually do is we make a choice. We say, this isn't right, this is the best way to go. And so we often have a lot of anxiety about this, we feel pulled apart, and we usually make a choice. We may conclude, for example, that one of the choices is irrelevant. Or we may conclude that these two contradictory elements shouldn't belong together anyway. But then, as Jung says, sometimes in human experience, and these events occur in the most profound relationships that we have, there may be something in the tension of these opposites that reveals a hidden meaning if we can hang on long enough. And here is where he talks about the fact that we must be able to hang on until something new, a third level, can be achieved. And he called this third level a reconciling symbol. Now, before one can experience that symbol, in their own mind, body, and soul, they have to go through a terrible disunion. In other words, you can't do what you ordinarily do in resolving opposites originally, make a choice and move on, and lower the tension. And that's the problem with all this, you see, when we deal with it that way. Well, anyway, I think that just is a little bit of an introduction in that direction. So today, then, I'm going to assert to you that the Songs of Solomon may be the greatest and most beautiful of all love guides for men and women, and will attempt to answer the reconciliation of some of these struggles that we have. And what I would like to do now is to have as the background for the Songs of Solomon a very brief review of what could be a whole other topic, and that is the sacred marriage, or the coniunctio, as defined by the alchemists in the Middle Ages. The alchemists were very interesting people, and I won't spend a lot of time on them, but basically they painted, they lived their deep inner spiritual journeys as they tried to make the chemical changes that they thought they were doing. And in the process, they defined many important events, and one of them, of course, was the marriage experience. And so now I want to show you some slides from the Rosarium Philosophorum, which is a 16th century document and with paintings, and the story of the sacred marriage, which involves a word called the coniunctio. The coniunctio means more than just a marriage. It means basically an initiation with marriage as the central feature, but it involves death and rebirth with the formation of a new family. So let's turn this on now, Deborah. Thank you. Okay, this begins, there's a lot of other aspects, but we're just going to use the core. This begins when the king and the queen meet in the sacred relationship. The left hands are forming the potential for union. They have the attraction to each other, and so the relationship is beginning. The dove of the Holy Spirit is going to preside over this relationship as they go ahead. All right, go ahead. This is just another picture of the same thing, the king and the queen. And again, the sun and the moon are important here, and I want to emphasize that because that comes up in the Songs of Solomon. Go ahead. So here now their clothes go off. This is where the persona, the outward appearances start to fade, and they get to know each other more intimately. The relationship, the intimacy develops, and they are now on the road to the marriage. Go ahead. Okay, same thing. Let's go ahead. This is just another addition here. I won't stop to explain that. I just put this in to show that in the process they do become aware that there is a difference here. Okay, let's go ahead here. Okay, now again, the same thing. Here they are again, the king and the queen meeting and the dove presiding over them. Go ahead. These are just different additions of the same thing. Okay, keep going. Same thing. Okay, now they're moving into the bath. The sacred bath is the environment, the vase, the sacred vessel in which they're going to have the experience. The waters of love, again, the dove presiding over it, over them, you see. And they're starting to go down. Go ahead, next one. Same thing, again, a different, if we were going through this, we'd talk about it a little more in depth. Go ahead. Now they're actually under the water, and they're now in the divine embrace. This is where the coniunctio, in fact, is occurring. The divine union is taking place here. Okay, and I notice it's underwater, under the sacred water. Okay, go ahead. Here's just another picture of it, other paintings of it. Go ahead. Another picture of it, and there's the potential of the. Already the potential child that will be born out of this is shown in the upper part of the vessel. Okay, go ahead. This is a more modest presentation. There are some alchemists felt that the union that took place in the sacred sexual embrace should never be shown. That's private experience for each party. So this was painted a little more modestly here. Go ahead. Okay, keep going. Now, these are other elements to it. We won't spend the time in this. Let's jump, I think. Deborah, go ahead to the next. Okay. Now, they've had the sacred union, and one of the first important lessons about this deep sexual connection is that death is in the offing. Now, notice that they have become one person. There's just two legs. They have become one. That's a good question. So, but notice there now, the marriage bed is now becoming a coffin. Okay, let's go ahead. Okay, this is another, and see, death is waiting around the door here. Here is again another view of it. Go ahead. And now, in fact, this is even a worse state. They both now are dying to this life, and the spirit of the relationship is ascending to heaven. Go ahead. And this is in the same thing. Now we have almost two spirits, and I'm glad that showed up because we're going to want to look at the idea of the quaternio, where there's two children born, not one. Go ahead. Okay, that's just the death, the whole death experience. Go ahead. And now the dew from heaven is coming back to revivify them. Go ahead. Same thing. Go ahead. Okay, I think let's go to number 54. Let's see. Keep going. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff here we won't stop to talk about. Okay, here we go. This is it. This is just one figure. There are many other kinds of figures, but this then becomes the end result as the divine child is born. And actually, it's one but two, and there's a lot of interesting symbolism about that, but I just want to have you leave you with the idea that now we have the divine child that's born out of this relationship. So again, let me try to define this. And the divine coniunctio, the divine sacred marriage, is the process of this ultimate transcendent union sexually in which both parties become one, one flesh, as we use the term from the scriptures. And in that process, they then go through a death and rebirth, and out of that comes the divine child or divine children. In fact, we're going to see at the very end what we have is the divine quaternio, the creation of the new boy and girl. And in fact, that's the origin of the divine family. All right, well, let's go ahead now, and you can turn that off if you like. Let's go ahead now and go ahead into the Songs of Solomon. Now, I hope all of you have some copies or can look in on some copies. What I have left you with is a Xerox copy of the King James Version of all the eight chapters of the Songs of Solomon. And then the other larger printed document is actually the one I'm going to focus on, which is the coniunctio itself, or the divine sexual love relationship. And I'm going to describe, mostly in summary form, how this takes place. And we're going to just focus on the main element here. Now there are basically five love poems. Now I realize some of you may already be saying, "Well, Joseph Smith said that the Songs of Solomon was not inspired." Gee, I don't. I didn't think that many people were going to be coming. But maybe we can lend some here and we can double up or something. Anyway, Joseph Smith said that this wasn't inspired. I think that was the early Joseph Smith. I think had he lived long enough and got back to the Songs of Solomon, he would have fallen in love with it. But that's just my opinion. Because I think it's such a wonderful completion to DNC 132. I have used most of the background for this from a remarkable book by Marvin Pope. It's the Anchor Bible series on the Songs of Solomon. It is a huge, massive, one-volume commentary on this work, and it is 800 pages. You simply can't believe the number of Jewish rabbis, Christian mystics, Catholic, Protestant, other theologians of every ilk that have interpreted the Songs of Solomon. They're very spiritual interpretations. They're very literal interpretations. It is truly a remarkable sacred book. And I just have nothing but great respect for it. So what I have done is I've taken some of the outlines of some of the great commentators and I've adapted to this with my own interpretation. And basically, let me just run through the sections. And we're going to just briefly describe those so you'll have a chance later on to go through on your own and in your own way, muse on this. Okay, the first is chapter 1 through 2:7. That's the first section. I'm going to describe these in each in more detail in just a moment. The next one is chapters 2:8 through 3:5. Poem 3 is 3:6 through 5:6, and that's going to be the key one. That's where the coniunctio occurs. Poem 4 is 5:6 through 6:12. That's where the initiation rite takes place. Poem 5 is chapter 1 through 8, 14. So that's just roughly the breakdown. Now, let me just detail a little bit more. I'm going to organize your thinking around these by these questions and how they're answered in the songs. Question 1. How is a young woman who perceives herself and inner experiences the least and lowly of other women, certainly not one of the chosen wives of the king or shepherd, Solomon, to become even a wife? Beyond that, how is she to become the chosen one? Is that even possible? Well, actually, the whole 8 chapters require that, so that question really underlies everything. Okay, question 2. What is the inner secret nature of the coniunctio, or sacred mystical marriage, as the substance and foundation for the eternal marriage relationship? This is developed in chapters 3, 6 through 5, 6. And I think that really is the key one we're going to spend some time on today. Number 4, how is the contradiction between the two poles of celestial marriage, eternal marriage and the covenant and plural marriage, reconciled? That is in chapters 5, 6 through 6:12. And again, that's the section we'll not spend much time on today. That's a whole other topic we may be able to do sometime for next year. Next, how does sealing occur in the sacred marriage, which again is one of the foundational principles of celestial marriage? Again, this occurs in chapter 7, 1 through 8, 14 in some remarkable ways. So basically, those are some of the rough outlines of how this is developed. Now, let me jump back to chapter 1, 2 through 2, 7. And I'm just going to summarize very briefly this section as I've interpreted. Here in this section, the prospective bride-to-be, who is the narrative voice or the female lover, desires to be the bride of the king or the shepherd, or King Solomon, as we presume. She is ancient and old. She identifies herself as the lowly one who has not been chosen. There are references to her being cast out by her brothers, for example. She desires to become the chosen one, even though she is the least among many women, and she is outside the family of the king. She is to become the one and only in her heart. She desires the romantic coniunctio or sacred marriage. She now has born in her heart the desire for this union. Now, in these verses, she seeks the absent lover, the king. Then there's a response by the chorus. These may be the other wives or women. Throughout the text of the Songs of Solomon, when you see references to the other women, that refers to the other wives and the relationships that are there. But then, in this section, King Solomon formulates a response. But this is a response, though, coming from her. It's his idealized response of what he wants from her. And what we find out at the end of this section, chapter 2, verse 7, is that all of this now is just fantasy. It's just a dream. It's an anticipation of what she would expect and hope for. And again, we could go into a lot of detail, but we won't do that this time. Poem 2 is very similar. It, too, is a fantasy and anticipation of what's coming up. However, in this in this second section, chapters 2, 8 through 3, 5, there's a stronger response. She becomes more intense. There's also suggestions that she's sleeping, that it's still a fantasy system, but she's wanting to make it more active and more realistic. In verses 3 and 4, there is an embrace. She grasps him. She grasps him with her legs, wrestling with greater urgency now to be sealed to him. This is one of the images of the potential of sealing. When a woman grasps a man by her legs, that may be one of the signs of sealing. This chapter now leads up to what I think will be the most important section for us to deal with, and that's poem 3, which is the actual literal deliverance of the coniunctio. This is chapters 3, 6 through 5, 6. The beginning verses here in chapter 3, though, really refer to a wedding event. And interestingly, this is a public wedding event in which Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, is going to crown her son for this public ceremony and marriage. And so here we have in the songs now the outward presentation of the marriage rite and ritual. But now what follows is the substance of the marriage. And this is very interesting, because now if I were to ask you the question, what is a marriage? How does it occur? I think most of us would say, well, a marriage occurs when you have this ceremony. And indeed, there is a ceremony. But to the Jews, the marriage was the sexual relationship, the substance of the relationship. And in fact, when you think about it, a ceremony can mean very little unless there's an actual relationship. And so what we're going to actually go through now is to read the experience of the marriage. Now, what I'm saying may sound obvious, but you know, sometimes we need to have the obvious stated to us. Okay. Let's go to chapter 4, verse 1. Now, beginning in this verse, the song moves to a more personal event with the King Solomon, or the shepherd, as he's alternately called, responds with great energy to this beloved young woman. As noted, she has generated a lot of energy and desire in the first several chapters, period. Let's go to verses 4, 1. Behold, you are fair, my darling. Behold, you are fair. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair like a flock of shorn goats streaming down Mount Gilead. Again, here the eyes are highlighted. The eyes are here focused on as the organ of sexual desire and invitation. Interestingly, Helen Fisher, in her studies of courting and grooming, I mean courting tactics between males and females, and this is true for men and women, and also for even the animal kingdom. The eyes seem to be the director of the whole process, and so I think this is interesting that it starts out this way. Interestingly, in the Mormon temple ceremony, the whole issue of the veil comes up here also, and the veil then hides the eyes. It may be, and again, I'm not offering any definitive interpretation, but it may be that the veil suggests some kind of privacy for this most powerful of all agents in the whole relationship. It's as though maybe when a woman puts on the veil, she is keeping herself only for her husband in a symbolic way. It conceals her face in that sense. He goes on to chapter 4, verse 2. Your teeth, like a flock of ewes coming up from washing, all of them twinning. And then there's an elaboration about the teeth, cleanliness and whiteness and so forth. And there's a lot we could say about amplifying each of these symbols, but I want to move ahead and kind of keep this in motion and come to the climax and move on to some of the implications. Chapter 4, verse 3. Like a scarlet fillet, your lips, your mouth comely, like a pomegranate slice, your brow behind your veil. Again, now we're getting closer to the lips and the mouth, and the whole meaning of that. There are some people have said that the key to any sexual relationship and love attachment is through kissing, that has more erotic power than almost any other activity. Moving on to verses 5, again, we're still in chapter 4. Your breasts like two fawns, twins of a gazelle browsing on the lotus. Here the breasts are compared to two fawns, leaving the idea that they are perfect in symmetry. It also may be referring to the nipples in their perfect shape to be the most attractive to look at. The twinning suggests a perfect symmetry. The gazelle represents a mixed statement. This refers back to some of the anticipations in chapter 2, referring to the male lover who may then, like a gazelle, be able to experience the breasts and the whole bodily experience of his love. Now notice as you go through this verse that there's a descending nature of the various organ systems of the female's anatomy. And it descends. There's a focus on the hair, the eyes, the teeth, the lips, the neck, the breast, the belly, and so forth. It calls to mind a verse from Proverbs which says, "Let thy fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love." Here the triangle of the breast and the belly are viewed as a theme of profound beauty and anticipation of nurturance. Now, in case you haven't guessed, I am one who believes that the union of sexuality and spirituality is the ultimate goal of all of this. Now, unfortunately, there are very few religions that really teach this. Hinduism in the East does. Virtually none of the Christian religions do, and all their derivatives. Basically, they separate spirituality and sexuality, the highest form being spirituality and sexuality being tied to the things of this earth. But Mormonism, Judaism, Hinduism, and there may be others, don't. They really attempt to bring at the highest pinnacle the union of sexuality and spirituality. And as Scott Peck said, anybody who's looking for spirituality is also looking for sexuality and its fulfillment, and vice versa. So again, just a comment here to see where our bias is coming from. And in fact, to me, this is the theme of erotic poetry, is to bring us in a truly evolving love relationship to that spiritual connection and pinnacle. And I think these are the kind of verses that bring us to that. Okay, let's go on to verses 6. "While the day breeze and the shadows flee, I will hie to the myrrh mountain, to the frankincense hill." This may be a repeat of an earlier verse too, again similar to that. Here again, the climbing the hill. Now I think we're moving into the whole experience of the vagina, the field of sexual penetration and entrance for the final coming together. Then we go on to verse 7. "You are all fair, my darling. No blemishes in you." These, of course, are remarks from the male lover. Again, verses 9. "You ravish my mind, my sister, my bride. You ravish my mind with one of your eyes, with a gem of your necklace." Here again, reference to the eye and its ability to stimulate sexual excitement. Verses 10. How fair you are, my love, my sister, my bride. Sweeter your love than wine, the scent of your perfume than any spice. Here now there's reference to the olfactory function. The odor of the garments is important. Perfume is alluded to. This may have reference to pheromones. Maybe most of you don't know what those are, but basically scientists have found that animals in all the animal kingdom, amongst human beings, we give up these very kind of odorless substance called pheromones. They're in our sweat, and they're in various locations in our body, and they have different responses. And some people have postulated that this is the basis of attraction between two people. And in fact, it may be that the scent and secretions of each other begin to perform the most powerful bond between the two lovers. And I think that may be true. Now, in contrast to that, I have dealt with a lot of rape victims. And the hardest thing for many rape victims to get over is the smell or odor of somebody that was trying to destroy them. They can get over most everything else, but that's the hardest one, which leads me to believe that the olfactory sense may be our greatest memory connection. You know, it's very interesting if that's true, because we so little deal with olfactory issues. You know, it's just kind of like out of sight, out of mind, you know. We sort of squelch it all. We put on perfume and all this deodorant and so forth, we really don't pay much attention to it. But I think here in the love relationship, it may be one of the most powerful elements of connection. And this is implied even more. Going on to verse 11, "Your lips drip honey, bride, honey, drip honey and milk under your tongue, and the scent of your robes is like the scent of Lebanon." Again, here is the interchange with the mouth, the tongue, saliva, and all of those elements. Now going on to verse 12, "A garden is locked, a garden locked is my sister bride, a pool locked, a fountain sealed." Here there are lots of connections to the woman and her the image of the garden and the erotic connection. very evocative, where she basically invites him to enter his garden and enjoy the delights and the fruits. But let's go on to chapter 5, verse 1, which I think then illustrates the fact that the conjunctio does occur. I entered my garden, my sister, my bride. I plucked my myrrh with my spice. And here I think the king now is giving evidence that that's what's happened. And in the following verses, he talks about that. He talks about being drunk with the wine of love. And those verses, I think, really are quite self-explanatory. As Pope says in his commentary here, the two lovers now at this point are hovering on the pinnacle of full enjoyment. Now, chapter 5, verses 2 through 6, here we have now, I think, the presentation of the experience of the relationship from the woman's point of view. And I think in the interest of time, I'll leave that for you to read. It's very interesting and very good. Very good guide. If you want to know what it's all about, read those verses. You won't have to go very far to know what's going on. Chapter 5, it's Marvin Pope. It's the Anchor Bible series called The Songs of Solomon. But anyway, let me just read this one verse 5. I rose to open for my love, and my hands dripped myrrh. Here in her experiences, fulfillment and completion of the conjunctio takes place. She now opens herself entirely to him, so she will cry out, more and more, come unto me, my bowl, my love. Her hands drip with myrrh, with the semen. She washes herself in the sacred experience of a total intermingling of their bodies together. It's almost as though what we saw on the slides takes place. They have become one. She confirms the oneness of the relationship. And I think that's then elaborated. Immediately, though, in verse 6 comes then the separation and the death and rebirth process. Now, again, let me just comment here about what has happened. And this gets to one of the most important lessons that I think it brings to us about this text and about love as it enters into truly a celestial marriage. And that is, what really is going on in the sexual way here? I think the psychoanalyst Didier Dumas said it better than anybody. He said, in erotic love, there is a process of the co- or interpenetration of sexual energies exchanged between two lovers. Each one becomes for the other the fulfillment of the deepest sexual and erotic longings. It is to be emphasized that this is a total body experience of ecstasy and energy. It is not just a genital experience. It opens the door to spiritual power and connections beyond just the physical. For example, I know for certain a lot of men feel and probably only experience a sexual relationship only through the genital mode. Dumas goes on to postulate that many men are jealous of women because they find that women are more ecstatic. They seem to be experiencing this throughout their whole body. Well, he goes on to show how women have an easier time perhaps in getting this, but basically the sexual experience as he describes it for a woman is wherein it begins in the genital area, but it spreads to the whole body and it becomes a total body ecstatic experience. And thus leads the way for the man or the lover to have the same experience if he can follow again her lead. And now we see why the Songs of Solomon spend so much time on all this anatomy and all the parts of the body, you see. This isn't just for, well, build-up. I mean, we talk about foreplay and build-up and love. Well, no, the real payoff is it's this circular, energic interchange. That is what real sex is all about. That's what real love is all about. That's what the marriage is all about. And that, to me, is a profound thing. That, to me, is a profound experience. And I want to tell you, being a psychiatrist and an analyst for 25 years, and having heard the intimate, detailed sexual lives of hundreds, maybe several thousand people, there are not many people who ever get to this experience
or even know it's possible. And so you see, we've come to the point now of describing what it means to have this relationship as opposed to pornography or masturbation or all these kind of pseudo-sexual kinds of things that go on in life. And that is, you are the party for the fulfillment of someone else's deepest fantasies and longings. Now, I don't know if you can find a better way to describe it. Perhaps there is, but that's the best that I can. And to me, I think that that must be the mystery behind then the marriage that takes place. Well, time is gone by. There's a lot more I could say, but I think what I'll do is just say that basically the other verses talk about sealing. They get into that. And the initiation rites for women is extremely profound. That, coupled with some verses in Proverbs, open the door to a whole new interpretation of the initiation and development of women. You know, women, particularly Mormon women, are looking for a rite of passage. You know, men have been doing this for a long time. Well, let me tell you, it's within the Songs of Solomon, I think women can find one of the most beautiful stories of the initiation rite of who they're going to become. And it's interesting, in chapter 6, verse 10, let me point that verse out to you. In that verse, she becomes the Queen of Heaven. That verse we want to just very quickly read. She becomes clear as the moon, fair as the sun, and terrible as the army of banners. And it's at that point where the lowly woman who was outside truly becomes the one and only. And how that happens is just truly remarkable. And again, let me also correlate something here. In the book of Revelations, this same terminology is used about the church in the symbol of Mary. And Joseph Smith, in his Revelations, three times in the Doctrine and Covenants, used the same imagery to talk about the church in the last days as the chosen one of God, the chosen one of Christ. So I think the bridging of the imagery is quite fascinating and interesting here. Well, with that, I'll stop and turn this over for further questions or comments. Or if there are no comments, that's just fine, too. Thank you very much. Comment.
I don't know if there's an answer to this. Maybe it's more rhetorical, but why has the book been pretty much not even discussed? I mean, I was trying to think what my personal knowledge of Solomon is. I had absolutely nothing there.
What do you think?
That's why maybe it's a rhetorical question, but... Yeah,
well, I'll tell you, you want my opinion?
Yeah,
okay, I'll tell you. My opinion is, unfortunately, Mormonism, with its rich doctrines of connecting sexuality and spirituality, has fallen prey, like I guess most people in American culture, to becoming Protestants and Catholics. And what is Protestant Catholic doctrine? We've inherited from the Middle Ages the doctrine of the depravity of man, the flesh is bad, the spirit's good. And hey, today, I don't know of, they're not, you know, I mean, Mormons are pretty repressed people about sexuality. We don't deal with it very well. That's just my answer, my comment. Deborah?
Could you wrap it back around to section 132?
Well, okay, I guess I didn't do that very well. Okay, I would take everything we've said about the Songs of Solomon now, and you can and tie it into DNC 132. Particularly verses 19 through 22. Verse 19 is the culmination of DNC 132. In fact, we ought to read that. Let's just read that for a minute. 19 through 22. In other words, what I'm saying is that if you take everything I've said today and tie it to this ultimate doctrine of sealing, okay, here it is. In other words, what I've been describing today is the underlying foundation for this state. And again, verily I say unto you, if a man marry a wife by my word, which is my law, and by the new and everlasting covenant, and it is sealed unto them by the Holy Spirit of promise, by him who is anointed, unto whom I have appointed this power and the keys of this priesthood. And it shall be said unto them, ye shall come forth in the first resurrection. And if it be after the first resurrection, in the next resurrection. and shall inherit thrones, kingdoms, principalities, powers, dominions, all heights and depths. Then shall it be written in the Lamb's Book of Life, and so forth. And then it goes on, and they shall pass by the gods, they shall be gods, glory shall be sealed upon them forever and ever. And then, of course, they will have endless increase. And in verse 22, for straight is the gate, and narrow the way that leadeth unto the exaltation and the continuation of the lives, and the few there be that find it, because ye receive me not in the world, neither do ye know me. But anyway, so what he's saying here is that that the condition for becoming gods and having this endless posterity and having this relationship, I am saying it's this kind of relationship out of love that the Songs of Solomon teaches us that is the basis for this. Again, some of the verses in chapter 7 and 8 talk about a sealing experience that I think then would link up to these verses more directly in 132. Comment back here.
A rough relationship to this and the centerness that it enjoys in one with the great literary critic Harold Bloom of our day and age said that the 131st section or the 132nd section and the marriage dimension and the marriage in it is the central part of the restoration of Gilgamesh Smith. And it shows what a long ways we have gone if we have reached the point that you alluded to in the idea of sexuality in Protestantism.
That is split off, yeah. Mm-hmm. You see, and again, back to the image of the sacred marriage on the slide, you see, again, I didn't have a chance to develop that theme that would relate to 132, and that is where the marriage couple go through a death and rebirth, and out of that rebirth comes the children. Comes the divine children, and that becomes then the image of the divine family. And really, you see, that's what Joseph Smith's concept of God came to be. It went from the traditional, almost Trinitarian concept that we almost see in the Book of Mormon in some ways, to this doctrine, which really is a doctrine that God is personhood, man, woman, and children, and family. That it's the family of gods. That is the last concept that Joseph Smith had. And so I think it fits right into this whole idea of this archetypal pattern, as Jung would say, this is an archetypal pattern. Comment back here.
Could you comment a little bit more on in your mind the connection between sexuality and spirituality? And obviously, in some context, we all know some things, sexual expressions that aren't very sublime.
Right.
High school locker room stories.
Right.
Then I think you're talking about a kind of mutuality. One thing that sex does is it takes us out of ourselves. It compels us to go out of ourselves. Some of us don't do that aspect of it very well. But is there something beyond the mere physical being of the beloved that maybe that points to, that the erotic points to?
Well, do you have any idea? Would you like to say more about that? Maybe you've got some ideas yourself.
Well, Viktor Frankl has a little bit to say about it. What's on the meaning of love? You're in the book called... The Doctor and the Soul talks about how the erotic is beyond the sexual, and also talks about how what we love about our partner is based on what's unique and singular, and that exists. That part exists whether the physical body of the beloved exists anymore or not.
Yeah, maybe it's a way of transcending it. Yeah. Okay. Good.
The erotic is that. He mentions first A, the sexual, B, the erotic, and C, the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
As the stages.
Yeah. Lady right next to you had a comment. Let's go to her.
I was curious if you had any idea how often this actually takes place. I'm very familiar with your theories, but I'm very familiar with one level, maybe two levels of what you've talked about. But when you take to that highest level of spiritual, I keep wondering if that happens to very many people or... Some of the good relationships I've seen, maybe that's why we're still together. I don't know.
Well, that's a hard question. I don't know. It happens maybe more than we realize, but it's more, I would say, more the exception than the rule. Comment here?
I would say that there's a lot of songs like, Oh Promise Me, I Love Thee More Than You Do, all those songs, would they, in a religious service, would they be out of place to sing?
Well, I don't. I guess it depends on which church you go to, I suppose. I don't comment here.
In light of the polygamous marriages, how is it possible that such a union between two partners could possibly take place? I think it would be almost impossible to achieve what you're talking about here with multiple partners.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is one of the, you know, maybe that's the biggest contradiction of everything, isn't it? Again, maybe next year we'll have a chance to talk about a section of it. But the songs deals with that issue because it's right in the matrix of that world and the whole process. You know, maybe between now and next year, why don't you read chapters 5 and 6 and see if you find the answers I got. But no, I don't know. I don't mean to make light of it. But no, you're absolutely right. And I'm sure in many cases it never happened, of course. Read back in the back. Yeah, you mean sometimes you say, well, you get married, well, did you fall in love or is there love? Well, you see, what we've talked about today is this is the marriage. If you have a marriage, this is the core of it. This is the core of it. Everything else is secondary. Well, that's a very interesting comment. Very interesting. That you may really have something. You know, I did. Harold Bloom really is great. There's a lot of things to that that are significant. Comment. Let's see. Let's go over here. Well, you know, I don't know. Could you imagine? Well, I think Joseph. Well, I don't know. I mean, he wrote the Revelation as he. Well, of course, Joseph Smith couldn't talk about a lot of things. He was still in a very protected kind of culture. He was having a lot of problems, as we heard earlier today. So it's hard to know. Right. See, I think if he had really later come back on the Songs of Solomon, he would have said it was inspired. But maybe that's one of the reasons he said it was that kind of old repressive attitude about sexuality's out here and spirituality's up here. Keep those two things apart. So, but I honestly don't know the answer. It's a great question. Come in.
Ron Doss claims this love life is so esoteric, he experiences orgasm from the neck up.
Yeah. Well, that may sound a little strange to some people, but that's right. There you go. I mean, the Eastern religions and the Hindus particularly can give us. Tantric yoga is very interesting along those same lines. Yeah, this whole sexuality is an entryway to a lot of spiritual experiences. Back to that comment. Yeah, you see, it's as though maybe this whole process is such that it leads to just untold spiritual dimensions. For example, what about mutual dreaming? What about two lovers who begin to dream the same dream or who go in meditation together, you see? I mean, these are some of the possibilities that are talked about. You know, it's a tremendous topic. But I think, and maybe I haven't made the point because we focus too much on one area. The question earlier is a good one. I mean, how does this link up to DNC 132? Well, I think it does. If you take the doctrine, you take the teaching, you take the elements that come out of the songs, and then tie them into that eternal union element that's in DNC 132, you'll have it. I see Carl Sandburg here. Carl, I want to recognize you. I already pointed out that you were the one that caused this whole thing when you raised that question. So, okay, I hope we're not. Any other questions before we stop?
Where did you get those pictures
of the king?
What language is that from?
Well, yes, so much Latin. It's from, there's a Norwegian, a Denmark, a man who's from Denmark who studied the alchemists of the Middle Ages extensively, and he has done tremendous research on this. And as a Jungian analyst, Jung was interested for many years in the alchemical process. He was looking for analogs for the individuation process. And again, I might say, this is part of the individuation process of two people. Again, if I didn't emphasize that part, it's how two people become totally themselves by this interconnection. That's what it's really all about. And so that's what this is from. It's from... the alchemical research is from a number of sources. I could give them to you if you're interested in finding them. Anyway, but one last question, then we can stop. Anybody else? Thank you. One question.
How much of the totally yourselves is common to each other?
How much what?
You said the union process is where individuals become totally themselves, and how much of that, how much of an intersection between that individuality is common to them?
Well, see, that's the paradox. The more you're able to, you know, you can't go through this kind of union unless you've got your own selfhood. And in fact, if you go through this in the way I think this is described, you become more yourself at the same time more united. It's a paradox. It's another one of those paradoxes. Well, thank you very much. We can go ahead and any other individual questions, we'll go after that. Thanks.